but the music while he's riding, that you were talking about the billowing cape and all that stuff, that scene is so long and they cut to so many different locations and the music is always like, "Ta-da-da, this is a man." I literally was picturing the lyrics in my head to this lyricless song is like, a man, he's a man.
Amazing. I want that to play whenever Sam comes home. Lillian, hello. It is a beautiful rainy day here. I am cozy and ready to do this podcast. How are you?
I'm good. I would describe how I currently am as the opposite of cozy because I'm currently like scooched on a bed next to a nightstand because I've got a little, unlike Piper, I don't do my own home renovation projects. I have a handyman doing mine, which means my office is currently full of crap. So yay. I'm in my guest bedroom, hunched over a nightstand, like all the cool kids podcast.
Well, you know, Sam and I were just talking about how messy his office / our podcast studio is for our other show, World Forge Pod. Check it out. And I was, you know, finding the silver lining in things as I tend to do. And I was like, no, it's just sound dampening. That's what it is. Mm. It's not piles of junk. It's stuff that makes the sound quality better. So there you go. In case you ever want to return to your messy office.
My messy office means that there are blinds on my desk and a mirror and a bunch of like dust wood shavings on my chair. I don't even know how that happened.
Sound dampening, Lillian. Sound dampening.
Splinters in my butt are fully for sound dampening only.
Yeah. You know how you throw sawdust on a mess? It soaks up sound the same way. So anyway, you said you had a great way to open this apart from us talking about sawdust butts.
If you thought that wasn't my opener, no. So we had an amazing update from one of our fantastic listeners. And I know I say that a lot and I mean it with such sincerity. I love our listeners.
We love you.
Oh, at AirGuide on Instagram, the host of Jane Eyre Files gave us finally an answer to the question we had last week, which was, what was that little sitcom that was being referenced at the end of the Jane Eyre Head adaption that we watched? And she said it's the Jack Benny Show. And we were, in fact, right. It was a reference because Rochester was the name of the butler on that show.
Fantastic. Okay. See, we've got enough smarts. We can pick up on clues. But thank you so much for letting us know what that was. I've heard of the Jack Bennett Show, never seen it before. So,
well, and we can tell you're a big fan because 5 seconds after hearing the name, you called it Bennett and it's Benny.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm close with him. And I also, I'm just trying to bring, you know, other period adaptations into this. So
yeah, I'm proud of you.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Lillian, are you ready to do, well, first of all, the adaptation that we watched for this week, got to say right off the bat, up there in my favorites. Really liked this. This was the 1943 movie adaptation starring Orson Welles and another lady whose name I don't remember. Joan Fontaine.
Joan Fontaine.
Hey, yo.
Bam, bam.
But yeah, so before we do all of our reviews, I just had to say that I liked it right off the bat. Dibs on liking it first. You go. It's time to give a short recap as fast as you can.
Okay. I'm going to start talking and then you hit the go button.
Will do.
So Jane in this is a small child and she has a little prince of a cousin who is constantly eating and her aunt hates her for it. So she gets sent away to school that she thinks is going to be good and turns out it was a bad time, rough time there. Mr. Broccoli is definitely trying to murder small children there, but she survives. And our fierce, fierce Jane gets a job offer and says, you can stick that where the sun don't shine. And then she goes and takes an incredibly long carriage ride with a cool little stop off and takes a second long carriage ride before she ends up at her new job with the cutest girl on the planet, Adele. And she's working there when she meets a man who tries to kill her on a horse and is very mad at her about that. And then they fall in love because it's her boss. And we all fall in love with our boss, classic. And then he proposes marriage. And it turns out that he's already married, big interruption. And then we just kind of look at them looking into a dark room. And that's where his current wife is. And Jane goes, I can't be here anymore. And then this Jane, very smart lady, goes, I don't like my family, but I'd rather do that than, you know, be fully homeless on the moors. So I go back to Bessie, who was nice to me that one time. And Bessie goes, oh, your aunt's really sick. And then her aunt dies. But she sticks to her guns and is still sort of like in this big empty house all by herself before she hears Mr. Rochester's name on the wind. And then in 1 minute, she sees him again. They fall. He tells her to leave anyway. They fall back in love. And then that's the end of the movie in 60 seconds.
Amazing. That was a longer recap, but you hit on some really good details that needed to be said.
How long was it? I just hate them.
1 minute, 48 seconds.
Damn.
That's okay. That's okay. You know, sometimes quality is better than quantity. No, reverse, whatever. It's cool.
Sometimes quality requires quantity.
Yes, there you go. So one of my first notes in the title cards of this movie, there were three writers for this adaptation. And I think those three men working together did a good job because I personally really like a lot of the changes that they made, specifically how the ending goes. Because yes, you mentioned that Jane does not idiotically spend all of her money on one carriage ride and then become a beggar. No, she smartly says to herself, that would be stupid. I'm going to go use my network of allies and find some help. So she returns to Bessie, the lady who in this version was quite kind to her as a child. Very sweet. Gave her this beautiful brooch, which I love that Jane wears throughout the entire film. So that way when she's like, oh no, my life is ruined. What can I do? Oh, that's right. This brooch was given to me by a kind lady. I'll go talk to her. So I loved that detail of, yeah, going back to the house, even dying Aunt Reed is way nicer than other dying Aunt Reeds. She says something nice to her. I can't remember exactly what it is, but simply, I think she's just like, she asked Jane not to leave her. Isn't that it? Because in other versions, she's like, get away from here. But then she's like, Jane, she's like, oh, don't leave me, Jane. And she's like, okay. And then she like, you know, passes away.
Yeah. I do think it's really interesting how different this was, which I find it really funny how obsessed with the differences I was in this, because yeah. I'm sure lots of people wouldn't notice, like, but like the way that they like switched around when she goes to see Aunt Reed, and I'll confess potentially a sin. I think it's just a way to keep my sanity. But I sometimes, when I'm watching these adaptions, will like, especially when we're doing it on YouTube, we'll do a little like, how long is she going to be away from the house? Like, how long am I going to have to watch her with her creepy cousins? Like, how long is this childhood going to be? And so I went to look and I was like, did we accidentally get a version that like is half of the movie or something? Because it was kind of on the shorter end and she hadn't left to go see Aunt Reed yet. And I was like, this is going to be a problem. So I like went and scanned and I was like, she gets married and then goes to see Aunt Reed. And I went, oh, that might've been a smarter way to do it, Jane.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting too, because we do still get that scene where Jane interrupts him playing billiards with Blanche to talk to him about something, but that's simply a matter of them asking about, of her asking for her pay, which he owes her. It's not a matter of her going to go see sick relatives.
Yeah. And she asks for her pay because she thinks he's getting married, which is honestly smart.
Right.
I think this Jane is definitely, they make her a lot more competent than past Janes.
Yeah.
And not to imply that regular old Jane Eyre isn't competent. I think she's really smart, but I think intentionally she's really like, it's a characteristic of her that she's pretty sheltered and like knows how to do the, like, she's very passionate, but she doesn't, she's not very worldly, which is talked about a lot, where this Jane is a lot more worldly and her passion comes out in things like turning down a job as a teacher, where that can, I just need to talk about that scene. And I think it plays into some other differences that I want to talk about a lot, but like the way Brocklehurst negotiates that job and like gives her that job, not the same exact thing, but the same energy is the way that job offers happen still in life today, particularly I think for women, where there's this expectation that you'd just be grateful that they offered you a job at all. Mm-hmm. This man went, we're going to give you 20 pounds a year. And only 10 of that is going to be taken for room and board, which means
and religious teachings.
We're going to give you 10, 20 pounds a year. And we're going to take half of that so you can live here. and you're only going to get half of that, which the salary that she makes for Mr. Rochester, to contextualize this at the time, 30 pounds a year, and they don't take any of that for her room and board. That's all money for her. But my level of angry when he did that and made it seem like she should be grateful, not only made it seem like, but explicitly said she should be grateful.
Yeah.
10 out of 10. It was the most like relatable to an experience that I have had, where people like offer you a job and they're like, you're welcome. And I'm like, actually, I don't want to work here for that.
Dude, I know. I wrote down for that one, teacher job, more like indentured servitude, where he's like, yeah, he's like, no, like orphan that I've kept here as if I was a warden to this prison. You are going to remain here and now work for me, like free labor, essentially. I'm going to give you 10 pounds so that no one can say that I'm enslaving you, but essentially like you're going to stay here and be grateful. And I agree, Lillian, the way that she stood there, firm jawed, back straight, like, I'm not taking this job. You can't make me. I'm leaving. I loved it. I was worried at first when he came in, he had the mail in his hand and there was a letter for Jane. And at first he tries to put her down. He's like, yeah, you advertise and no one is going to respond because nobody wants you. You have no skills. And he looks down into his hand and there's a letter for Jane and he knows what it is. I was worried he was going to like burn it or throw it away or something. So I love that he just left it on the table and she's like, yoink, I'm out of here. Bye. Ugh.
Well, and I think that that was one of the things that was pretty different in this, was just how they played Jane's strength. But I also think your point around indentured servitude was really great, because that to me, like, that is what he's comparing it to, right? Like, he thinks that that's, and I think that that's a theme in Jane Eyre in general, is like, what are the expectations for a woman? And then what is Jane? Like, that's a lot of what we're supposed to be comparing it to. And I think that that's a lot of where we see the difference in these adaptions when they're the product of their time, right? We talk about that a lot. Yeah. And it's interesting how it's this adaptation of what the 1847 expectations of women are, but how much the time that we're watching its expectations of women play into it. It's like our ideas of what a woman is and what that really means have changed so much between 1940 to now.
Yeah.
And you can see how much the expectations of like, what is a strong woman in 1940? Like, that's what that is like, we're seeing in their mind, that's what this Jane is doing, is like taking that same contextual story, but inserting a little bit of like a strong 1940s woman, and that woman doesn't take this job.
No, I'm so proud of her for that too. Before we get too far from like the past and everything, I have to say, if I were doing this recap, I would say, okay, so we open on Harry Potter. I mean, Jane Eyre, because she's like literally in like a little like closet. It looks like his place under the stairs, but hers is like up in an attic, which again, I love when adaptations make parallels between Jane and Bertha. So they come and they take her out of the attic closet. I loved in the beginning there too, they were playing a lot with dramatic angles of shooting from below when we are in Jane's perspective to see these towering adults looming above her. Lots of good framing where at one point when this like mean butler tells her to go into the drawing room to see her aunt, Jane looks like a tiny little doll up against this enormous door. And like right in the foreground, we see the imposing back of this servant who's like, go in there right now. And Bessie's there like, don't be mean to her. Like, she's scared. And he's like, I don't care. So lots of really good framing and cinematography with that. I also, the black and white stood out to me a lot. And I thought they used it really well. I think the scene where it caught my attention most was there's a scene first in Lowood School where Jane is put up on her stool and told to stay there for like 24 hours. And it cuts to nighttime, and the way they do lighting in that room with the shadows of these great beams like above her, it's like kind of, you know, it does that sort of noir thing where they kind of cast these bars of black light as if she's almost imprisoned. That was beautiful. The other point where the black and white really stood out to me is when she first arrives at Thornfield and it literally looks like a horrifying Gothic castle. I just thought everything visually was so cool and I really loved it.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think one note on the castle, and then I have a lot of things within the childhood that I really want to talk about. One of the things that I found really interesting visually was how filmmaking at the time, like one of the things that I know that they did was drawings, and then they'd put the drawing on the lens. And so they'd have like a little window cut out. And there's a lot of scenes with the castle where I, similar to like watching old CGI, where at the time when I watched it, it didn't stand out to me. But mm-hmm. now you go back and watch some CGI from like 2002 and you're like, oh, that's very fake alien, huh? That it felt similar to me where I was like, that's really good for the special, they're doing special effects, right? Yeah. Like for the mm-hmm. special effect of this shot of a fake castle, that's really good at the time. But it also was like, what a cool way to solve the problem of you can't get a lot of exterior shots of castles.
Yeah.
So I found that, again, like to play into the visuals, really, really interesting.
I liked too that it made the castle feel more stylized, like where before in some of these other BBC adaptations, they're filming at actual historic houses. But here I liked that it did look like a Dracula's castle. And when she enters it, it's completely dark because it's late at night. And here comes this old woman holding a candle through the darkness. It's very spooky. And I really liked that kind of setting. And how often Rochester refers to it as a dungeon, which I'm sure Rochester's and other versions have said. But here, like with the castle setting and the dungeon, and it's a place where this crazy woman and the secret of his past is kept locked up. So he hates being there as a reminder of it. And he himself feels imprisoned while he's there. I thought that was all great and tied in together really well.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I do want to go back and talk about Jane's childhood really quick. And I know that I'm always the one trying to move away from that, but I have really important things to talk about with that, specifically her little prince of a cousin. Oh my God.
His blonde curls.
His blonde curls and his little shirt with the super high-waisted velvet pants.
Yeah, he's a fancy boy, a little lad.
And then he's just sitting next to his mom eating cookies. And my favorite, I don't know if you picked up on this because this, I was watching his face the whole time, because usually he's not in the room when the Brocklehurst is giving the little speech about hell. The cutest little Jane. Like, yes. I don't know where they found these gorgeous little girls that are like peak cuteness, but like Jane, Helen, and Adele are so cute.
Yes, agreed.
Kind of mean to do to me. but then it's framed in such a way where we're seeing Brocklehurst looking down on Jane. And in mm-hmm. the background, you can see her aunt who's sitting there going, yes, yes, great lesson. Mm-hmm. Yes, be mean to this child. She is probably going to hell. And she should cry about that at night because I lied earlier. And so she's going to go to hell about that. And then her cousin is sitting next to his mom eating these like just cookies, which like, they're like trying to make him like gluttonous and fat and shitty. And I'm like, that's not my favorite thing. But he starts to look kind of worried as they talk about hell. And it's just watching his face the whole time. I was thinking, I don't know about hell. I've lied pretty hard.
Yeah, dude. He's like, that's where I'm going though.
I don't want to get in trouble right now, but based on what you're saying, I think I'm going to burn in hell for all eternity.
Well, dude, yeah, he deserves it though. He's a bad boy. He grows up
to be a bad man.
Exactly. Yeah. Speaking of child actresses and Helen, did you recognize her?
No.
She is played by Elizabeth Taylor.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And that's now I kept meaning to like pull up Elizabeth Taylor's IMDb, but she's Gone with the Wind, right? Or is that a different actress? No. Okay. Cause
Gone with the Wind came out 4 years before this.
It did?
Yeah. Huh. I just looked that up cause I had a reference to it that I wanted to talk about.
All right. Well, anyway, Elizabeth Taylor is Helen. She's uncredited in this role, but I found it in the trivia and I recognized her face when I saw her. I thought this was another great detail that the writers added to this, is where before all depictions of her relationship with Helen, it seems so sad and distant. There is kindness there, but Helen is usually so religious and subservient that it hardly feels like she ever gives back to Jane, apart from just simply being like, oh, here's some food, let's be nice, but also remember to obey the teachers and everything. But here, it was so cute them like out on that hilltop when they're taking care of the laundry, and they're just like kind of playing with one another, and Jane is dreaming about where that road leads, like to the continent and to all these great countries, and that she wants to go on that road someday and explore. And then this Dr. Rivers comes up, which when that name was first said, I was like, Rivers, isn't her cousin's name Rivers? I was like, is this going to be a family member? But then they changed all that because they were like, we don't need this whole weird, you run into your cousins by chance thing. Again, smart. So mm-hmm. instead they had this kindly doctor character who I really liked.
I think talking about, I really wanted to talk about Dr. Rivers mm-hmm. and specifically those three men that you talked about who wrote this movie. They took a lot of pieces of like side characters that could be very easily seen as unimportant mm-hmm. and changed them. And specifically, every time they changed them, it was a man. So I specifically want to talk about the Dr. Rivers character and the role that he played. I wrote down while I was writing this, oh, he seems like really interesting and nice. And like, it makes me like her childhood a lot more because I like that this character is there and mm-hmm. there's somebody in her corner and all this stuff. And I went to look it up to see if he was in the book. And I realized that this is only a character that exists in the 1943 movie. This is not a character that is like cut out of other adaptions, mm-hmm. but the role that he's playing does cut out a character that is in several of the adaptions, which is the teacher.
Yeah. Miss Temple.
Kind of teacher, Miss Temple. Mm-hmm. I think that we've all established that in some situations I need to leave my feminism at the door, but I just want to quickly note that they wrote a new character and put him in a new position where a man came in to save child Jane and to advocate for child Jane and the women in that school are weak and incompetent.
Yeah.
They just like do whatever and they mm-hmm. don't stand up to anyone. And I genuinely think that that is a weakening of the story of Jane Eyre. Mm-hmm. Because in the story of Jane Eyre, it's subtle, but yeah. there are all of these women who are not necessarily in positions of power, mm-hmm. but still stand up to authority in a softer way that women often do and are often yeah. forced to do.
Yeah.
And I think that teacher is such a great example of that. Mm-hmm. And the fact that usually those two servants that go get Jane out of the room are both women. Mm-hmm. And the fact that one of the servants was a man, mm-hmm. that's not usually the case. And that Bessie is just, instead of being like a participant in raising Jane, who does care about her, but cares about her in this kind of harsh way, is put into this position of a more traditional woman where she's like, oh, poor little soft Jane. And it's the man who's being a little bit more harsh. It was something that I noticed in a couple of other situations. For example, Brocklehurst has a whole bunch of dudes that are in there talking about Jane and making decisions about Jane. Most of those don't exist.
Well, that's supposed to be the chair, the board that oversees the school, which I would believe if they ever showed it in versions would probably be all men historically. So I don't think they're erasing characters in that scene. That's simply like the first time we've seen this kind of board of directors who have come to, you know, make judgments about the kids.
Is it the 73 that has where he gets fired for being so bad to the kids? I think it's the 73 where they do have a board that comes in and fires him because
I think you're right.
Conditions where they're dying.
So I definitely hear what you're saying and very good points. Accurate 100%. I think it is definitely a product of it being made in the 40s and mm-hmm. they did that. Yeah, I agree. No.
Well, and I do agree with you that I like a lot of the changes that they made and I like the way that they framed that story a little differently, but I think it's one of the things that I like about stories where there's lots of different women who display mm-hmm. a lot of different kinds of strength.
Yeah.
And I think by not including those other women, mm-hmm. they are narrowing strength to this very specific version that this Jane is showing us. Yeah. And I think that one of the things that I like about some of the other adaptions is showing just the different sides of women and how they can be different things. And all of those are, some of them suck, but they're all, it makes women more three-dimensional in the way that male characters have always been able to. And that is the end of my feminist diatribe for now.
Well, thank you, Lillian. It's always good to bring some very important perspective into this discussion. So it's not all just romantic fan service. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Now, anyway, back to swooning over men.
Yeah.
I think should we maybe like let's just talk for a second about Orson Welles' Rochester. How about that?
Great.
I personally liked him a whole lot. I liked him, like he's in my top few Rochesters. I haven't taken the time to like organize them all, but his voice surprised me, which shouldn't, because like that's like one of his first famous things ever. I mean, he like his kind of story began when he was doing that radio broadcast of War of the Worlds. As everyone should know, he was the man behind Citizen Kane, the movie considered to be one of the greatest films ever made by many. But yeah, every time he spoke, I was like, whoa, that voice does not seem like it should come out of that man. I liked the voice. I liked how intense it was. I liked how tall he was, his look. I felt this is also very much a version, I think, where he looks very much like a man styled in like a 40s film. Though at times I wrote down that he looks kind of like a swashbuckling kind of pirate guy with like his big billowy shirt and everything. But I liked his performance. He's not my favorite Rochester by any means, but like I like him way better than like the 70s one that we just saw. I think he's way better than Sirian Hines. Yeah, he had that kind of short temper, but I also felt that he was rather quick to realize that he was being unreasonable. And so even when he, in those first kind of scenes, when he is kind of being demanding, he almost instantly then he's like, I'm sorry, that was weird of me to say. Anyway, what I meant was, but so I liked that.
Well, and since this is an audio medium and not a visual medium, I will tell our listeners, I just nodded incredibly dramatically when you said that, because that is absolutely the most important thing to me about this Rochester. I agree with you. Nice tall man. Gotta love it. Like that big presence, his voice, like all very Rochester-esque features. I think the thing that I liked the most, and it really... I don't know that I would have picked, I know I wouldn't have picked up on this had we not been watching so many different adaptions, but I think it plays into one of the big things that we talk about so often, which is how much of that like passion that Rochester has overrides him being a good person. Like how forgivable is he? How redeemable is he? And I think that what I really loved about the way that they played this Rochester is they didn't tone down his passion and his anger and his just general ability to be an ass. They didn't play that down to make him not to redeem him. They didn't be like, well, he's actually just like a soft, soft, sweet boy. Mm-hmm. They played him as a harsh man.
Yeah.
But they played him as a harsh man with awareness and with the ability to go, I actually did F up there and that was like my bad. Like, I think a line that we've seen in other things is when he sort of like makes a demand of Jane and then goes, I'm sorry, that was a command. I didn't mean it to be. I'm used to saying things and people do that.
Right.
Please sit down.
Yes.
Like, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
And I think that energy of that moment played better in this than any other adaptation that I've seen. Like the way that he does that, where I totally believe that he's just used to walking into rooms and telling people to do things and they do it.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know how to turn that off.
Right.
But his awareness of that and that energy of that moment plays into his entire interpretation of the character.
Yes.
And I loved it. It was so good.
I loved it too.
Because I like a man who's a little bit angry in fiction. But he has to have that self-awareness and he has to respect her.
Yes.
And it was so clear that he respected her.
Yes. Oh my God. The ultimate thing ever in any relationship, you got to have that level of respect, and it's there for sure in this. I liked, because we get what we see in a lot of versions too, where before we meet Rochester, we hear from both Mrs. Fairfax and from Adele talking about how he is a strange man. Like sometimes he's really scary, but also there's lots of things that are wonderful about him. And I thought Orson Welles was able, like you say, to demonstrate both sides of that. And I think the thing for me, a big thing that always kind of is a deciding factor in whether or not I like a Rochester is how he interacts with Adele. So at first when he was talking to her, he was pretty dismissive and mean. And I was like, okay, well, that's not great, but it's a movie from the 40s. So maybe that's the thing. But oh my gosh, the big moment for me, I wrote this in all caps, is after the burning bed scene. First time any adaptation has done this. After they have their moment, he instantly, like, they're all romantic-y, but then he's like, oh my God, Adele, what about Adele? He's the first one who wonders. He's like, wow, there's a lady burning beds in this house. Maybe I should check on my ward. And he and Jane run into Adele's room together. And there's a scene where they're just like standing over her bed, looking down at her. They look like parents worried about their child. And it's so sweet. And it's like, oh my God, he loves her. Yay.
Again, nodding away over here. the that same scene. So earlier he had yelled, or essentially like yells at Adele because she came in dressed like a ballerina with the outfit that he bought her, mm-hmm. and he yells at her and she walks into the room and Jane immediately goes, that was mean. And he's like, sorry, I shouldn't have taken my experience with her mother out on her. And I'm like, thank you.
Yeah.
Dying. So like the awareness, like the emotional intelligence that this man has, he's got to get that next step of not be mean, but still so good to immediately think that. And then the first thing that he says, they run into the room fully. I have fallen in love with this man as he runs into the room. And then they go look over her cutest little angel sleeping in her bed. And he notices that she's holding the ballet shoes.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, she needed to comfort herself after I was such an ass. Like immediately like sees that, puts together that story. Not only it's not just the way that he treats Adele, because I think that is, this really leaned up for me on how much does he know Adele, like
right.
as her own child, as her own person, mm-hmm. versus I think particularly the 73, he treats Adele like this metaphor for her mother.
Yeah.
And doesn't even see her as a child, where like this, he has those triggers for himself. Like it brings up that trauma for him, mm-hmm. but he sees her as her own person.
Yeah.
And who couldn't? Because my God, she's cute.
I wrote down little cupcake. Like she's got the ruffliest dress in the world. She literally looks like a little dancing pastry. I love that our introduction to Adele is, so Jane goes to bed this first night in the spooky castle, but she wakes up to this little music box and she leans up in bed and hears a music box sitting at the foot of, at her feet. And it's got this little ballerina and this little soldier. And then peeking through the curtains comes little Adele. And she's like, good morning. Are you my teacher? I'm Adele. And it's just like so sweet. And what is, she has a line that's so nice where she's like, this is the nicest way I've ever woken up in my life. It's something like that, that she tells her. I'm like, that's so cute.
Every little bit about how they play this little family, because I think you're right. They're definitely playing it like they're having Jane really lean into that mother role in a way that they haven't necessarily in the past. I mean, there's obviously a little bit of that, but she's always the governess, where this, she's very much in that mother role. And that happy family that we talked about in the 2006 with like the little, they did the little shopping trip as a family. You see that Adele was in the background shopping.
Oh, so and cute.
Just the whole way that they play up that idea of family. And even again, I've talked about this with other adaptions, another moment where somehow we forget Adele exists, but at the very end, after the fire, when she goes back to him, he immediately is talking to Mrs. Fairfax and he goes, can you go get Adele her dinner? Like, again, Adele still exists. She's a whole person. She's a whole character in this. And I love it.
I know. When he said that at the end, I was like, yes, he kept his daughter. I'm so glad. The family shopping scene in this, it was very short, but my God, was it cute? Because you can really see how excited he is that they're, oh my God. So first he goes and finds Jane, who is doing a lesson with Adele. This is right after she's accepted his proposal. And he's like, what are you doing? And she's like, I'm doing a lesson. And he's like, the hell you are. Like, I'm marrying this lady. What do you think about that, Adele? And she's like, oh, this, I couldn't imagine a better like mom, except maybe Mrs. Fairfax. And it's like so cute. Like,
she what says little, not even Mrs. Not Fairfax.
Even Mrs. Fairfax. It's so cute. And then like he, as they go on this quick little montage, he tells like three people, he's like, this is my wife. We're getting married. I'm so jazzed. Like he's so excited about it. It's really cute.
It's so cute. I think we could just talk about Adele all day. I do want to talk about a super specific moment about this. Rochester is like, they do a lot of like, she's a man. Like, such a man. And one of those moments, they've done a lot of implying that Rochester wanted to kill Adele's mom's lovers out of jealousy. I don't know if you picked up on it because it was a blink and miss it moment. He killed him.
Yeah.
The actual line I wrote down is, at least I had the pleasure of putting a pistol bullet through my rival's lungs.
Yes.
And I just wrote down, you shot him.
Yes, you murdered this guy. Yeah, because like in other versions, they say that he shot him in the arm. So he like wounded the dude. This one flat out killed him. He's like, no, 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 no. You sleeping with my girl? Bang, you're dead. It's just like, oh yeah, now, fight for your lady.
And now we don't know if she's my daughter or not, but you know, the other guy's dead. So it's all fine.
Dude. dude, I think I also gave him major style points. He's got an incredible swooshy cape that we see him returning from some, I presume, like gloomy walk on the moor where he's thinking about all of his sadness. But he returns in that beautiful cape. He's got great fashion throughout. So major points for that. You talked earlier about how well he conveys his passion. I think this is also a version where the way that they play just the looks between the two of them really conveys their feelings for each other. This is a version where you definitely get the sense that Jane, without having to spell it out, is in love with this man. Like the actress does a great job of the way that she longfully stares at him and he does too. I wrote down a line somewhere. I think it's later on. Oh, yes. After the party, you know, where she, you know, sees him with Blanche singing and everything and she gets sad and she goes off. Like he goes after her and he looks so concerned. And I wrote down, I'm just like, oh my, he loves her so. I think they did a lot of this stuff just really, really well.
Yeah. I think a couple other things I have on him being a man. Because I totally see what you're saying with those things. And I absolutely agree. There's lots of those longing looks that we talk about how much we love those. But the music in this peak 40s music, we talked about it with the 57, although unlike with that, they do have more than two quarters in this movie. So, but the music while he's riding, that you were talking about the billowing cape and all that stuff, that scene is so long and they cut to so many different locations and the music is always like, ta-da-da, this is a man. Like, I literally was picturing the lyrics in my head to this lyricless song is like, a man, he's a man.
Amazing. I want that to play whenever Sam comes home.
Well, it's a billowy cape in the wind. I also wrote down the thing about the cape.
Yeah.
Because it's the cape is a whole character.
Dude, it's amazing. In the like getting run over thing. So that is a dangerous scene, more so than others we've seen. First, a Great Dane plows her over. She gets run over by a dog first. Sweet pilot, we love you. It's okay. But then literally the way that like that's, I don't know if they swapped her with a stunt double to have that horse practically put its hooves into her face. But I was like, damn, that could have hit somebody for real. That looked intense.
Well, in the way that that horse got up, I don't want to think about it too hard, but this was not a time when movies put no animals were harmed in the creating of this film.
Yeah.
And that's all I'm going to say on that one.
Lillian, it could have been a very well-trained horse who knows how to rear when you want it to rear. You don't know. Let's try and give it the benefit of the doubt. At least I want to.
Okay. Well, yeah, for sure. They just trained it with treats and stuff for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, who knows? Who knows? We also got another scene here where it's just Rochester confronting Blanche about her fake intentions.
Yes, which we get so much more of the Blanche and Rochester's relationship. Like
yeah.
The way that they like banter back and forth in this like cutting at each other and his like brutal honesty. Well, she's like, hey, don't be a dick, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Although I was really intrigued by his line there. He's like, I have given you the compliment of pure honesty. I mean, that's really interesting because you can read that. I think it's really based on, you know, the person you're saying it to, their personality, how they read the situation. I think knowing him, that is a compliment. He's like, I hate this fake society world that we live in. He craves honesty and intimacy. And so to just say to her face, he's like, hey, you're a spoiled brat. You only want me for my money. Please admit that and stop with the charade. And her being like, whoa, Jesus Christ. Like, I thought we were going to play this game a little longer. And he's like, I'm busy playing a game with somebody that I actually care about. So I can't play two games at once, Blanche.
It's a lot of games. It's a lot. I got a lot of balls in different courts and it's one too many. So you got to go.
Exactly.
I will say I like that. I did get the energy from that. Like I'm the gift of being honest with you. I'm like, you're not wrong. But also it just reminded me specifically of this former boss of a boss that I had who would always say that he was being authentic. He was like, I'm just being authentic. Yeah. And he was just being a dick. Like he would just like say things. He would overshare. The biggest example is this woman got laid off and I really liked her and I really respected her. And I thought she was really good at her job, but she wasn't what we needed on the team. Like I understood why she got laid off. Like it just hiring her in the first place didn't really make a lot of sense to me. But they laid her off and then he called everyone into a conference room while he railed against all the reasons she got fired. Oof. And why she wasn't right for the team and like wasn't competent and like all these things. And I'm like, you don't need to do that. Like you can let people go with respect. And it was confusing authenticity with respect.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a line that's really important to walk. And I think this Rochester in that moment with Blanche was dancing on that line of like, you can be honest with her without being disrespectful. And that's kind of how I felt about it.
Yeah.
But I also have trauma. So
totally, totally. I mean, he still is everything that's been said about him before, where he's a strange kind of angry dude, doesn't really care about pleasantries. So yeah.
But he's nice to that little girl. So I'm in love with him.
Yeah. I wrote down too, I loved that Jane goes and says goodbye to Adele before she leaves. There are so many smart details that were added to this. I'm like, you did good. Three men who maybe made sexist choices, but otherwise good storytelling.
Well, and I think if you're going to make changes to a story this classic, it's really important to make those changes with intention and to make it better or fill in gaps. Or in so many ways, like I'm not even criticizing this book of Jane Eyre, because I think we've talked about the fact that A, we haven't read it, and B, it's just a different medium. And so you, when you're dealing with that difference, the way that you can explain things and make things more of a metaphor by including details about the way the characters are feeling in those moments and all of that good stuff, that's great. But if you're not going to be able to add that layer of context, just putting a scene in because that's what's in the book is the wrong way to do it.
Right.
And I think that that's where a lot of their changes came from, was like, this was a better way for us to tell the story. Like that's how it felt to me, rather than it being like criticizing flaws in Jane Eyre, the story, which I think we could do, but neither of us have read the book. so it would be incredibly hypocritical and wild of us to do. But I think instead it's about the strength of that adaptation and the way that they're going about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, because we do have to wrap this up soonish, but let's talk about the other big detail that they did in this that was way different. Like you said, in your recap, we never see Bertha. He takes them up to the tower. He opens a door. You hear kind of animal noises. And then he goes into this dark room. There's the sound of chains and he comes out. And then the camera perspective changes to being inside the room as if we're seeing through Bertha's eyes. And he stands there in the doorway pointing. And he's like, that is the thing I'm married to, versus the woman. And he gestures to Jane, who most beautiful bride we've seen so far, in my opinion, her hair, her dress, all of it gorgeous. He's like, versus the woman I want to be married to. And I think it's a very interesting choice, us never seeing her, so that we have no face to relate to. They take away her humanity as being just this animal sounding thing in the shadows. So I feel like that's their way of helping us empathize with him. Again, still never okay with this decision, but it makes it easier to ignore the problem, I guess.
Well, and I think that that's one of the things that's generally hard about doing a movie is like, and I almost want to do like a whole episode where we just talk about Bertha as a metaphor, but like the character of Bertha, as I understand her from the book and from what I've seen other people talk about this stuff, she's really a metaphor. She's not like, she's kind of a person, but she's mostly a metaphor. And so when you're making a movie and you see her, it makes her a person.
Yeah.
And we see her back because she jumps out and tries to strangle Rochester, but she immediately gets thrown back into the room. And I completely agree with you. I think it does make Rochester more sympathetic by reducing her humanity, which problems there for sure, but let's not unpack that.
Yes.
But I do think one moment that I did have where I was like, oh, what an interesting way to play Bertha. And like, we don't really know anything about her, but it's almost like that's not what's relevant to the story in the way that they're telling it, blah, blah, blah. And then they close the door and it's full dark in there. And I'm like, do you keep her in the complete literal darkness?
Yikes.
Like it was meant to be a transitional thing where like it closes it, it's dark, and then you go to the next scene. But I'm like, no, but I do need to know if she gets 4 square torch a day.
Yeah, seriously. Someone holds a flame in front of her face so she doesn't go blind and then they leave. Like, yikes.
So rough.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, I feel like we've touched on most everything that I have notes about. Again, I just want to really reemphasize, love the choice that she falls back on her network of allies. She sees she sees Bessie. She somewhat makes amends with her aunts, is there taking care of Gateshead until like she has no money. So the property has to be sold off piece by piece. She's there in this big drafty ballroom. She can't keep the windows closed as the storm is blowing in. And she's got the start of a letter where it seems as if she's going to like maybe go back to Mr. Brocklehurst and accept an offer from him. But then luckily, you know, she doesn't do that. And I do love too that Dr. Rivers returns as well. And he's the one who's kind of been like, hey, so this guy's been looking for you. And I just really liked seeing her reconnect with like these people from her past, for them to see, look how far you've come, Jane. And for her to have that kind of growth and reflection as well. Of course, what is interesting is that this removes, did we, in this version, did they talk about her inheriting from her uncle? That's not a thing.
Yeah, so, no, they keep the moment of the lawyer looking for her, but they switch it so that while the implication is they don't actually say it's from Rochester, they just heavily imply it. And the whole time I'm sitting there, I'm like, well, don't burn the letter in case it's 20,000 pounds.
Yeah.
Like a different man. Like, we think we know who it is, but do we?
So the interesting thing too, when she, you mentioned that she has a couple of long carriage rides in the beginning of the film. And at first she's dropped off at this inn. There's a guy there who is like this kind of drunk, and he's dressed like a fop. And he's like, I want to buy that lady drink. And she's like, oh, no, thank you. I don't want that. But I think this was the writer's nod to her uncle. I don't think they're saying that it is her uncle, but he offers her Madeira. And Madeira is a wine made on the island where her uncle lives. And I think it's even implied that he is a wine merchant or a vicar, a vintner, wine, whatever, yeah. Words. So I think that was a nod to her uncle. But at first, when I saw that guy, I'm like, is that supposed to be her uncle? Like, is she going to meet him now? But that didn't happen. So yeah, that was all very interesting.
Totally different way to tell that story, which would be interesting, but really, really different. Yeah. I did want to talk about that because this is the only time that we see another, there's implications that Jane needs to protect her purity in the way that like all women need to protect that. But this is the first time we actually see another man fully hit on Jane.
Yeah.
And what I loved about that is immediately I was, because anytime there's an actress that gorgeous playing Jane, you're like, are you going to pretend that she's not pretty? Because that's bullying. That's mean to do to me. I worked really hard to love myself, and that's just a kick in the gut. That's not nice to do. But they did, they absolutely didn't. They implied Orson Welles wasn't hot, but they did. They did do a lot of like, Jane is gorgeous and there's nothing that we can do to pretend that she's not.
Yes. Yeah.
Which I enjoyed.
I like that too. I stand by the fact, this statement, most beautiful bride, Jane. Just absolutely stunning.
I do have like a super light bonnet watch. She had a really, really standard, I don't want to say boring, because I liked it. It was the like little black dress of bonnets.
Yeah.
And I think the outfits, I want to almost change bonnet watch in this particular adaption, and maybe forever, into a general fashion watch, because Adele's outfits we talked about a little bit, but so good. So much character in that. And like the way that that actually plays into Adele's character, and the fact that that means that Rochester bought her so many different dresses.
Yeah.
And her little hat, she does wear a lot of really good hats in that. So those are so fantastic. I also wanted to talk about the general vibe of Mrs. Fairfax. Like, she's always an older lady, mm-hmm. but she looked so frail and fragile. And I just wanted to wrap her up in a shawl and tell her to sit down. And a note to draw back to the ending. When they tell the story, this is the only time every other adaption, Rochester saves everyone in the house. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Fairfax saved everyone in the house.
Dude, like, really? I didn't pick up on that.
She immediately ran to get Adele. She goes, I noticed there was a fire. I ran to get Adele. I wrapped her in a damp shawl and I ran her out of the house.
Oh, Miss Fairfax.
Mm-hmm. And then Mr. Rochester came running out after her, and that's when they see Bertha. And then he goes back in to get Bertha. Mm-hmm. But Mrs. Fairfax saved Adele. And I'm like, I'm going to be totally honest with you. I don't think you could pick her up.
Yeah.
I think Adele is very small in this, and I don't think you have the strength in those little blue bones.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, I liked her too. She was very soft-spoken. She did a good job of setting the tone of the spooky castle when she greets her, and like everything is in whisper. Then she just kind of keeps up that whisper for the rest of the movie, but I was okay with it. Just real quick, want to note that the actress who played Adele also played Tootie in the movie Meet Me in St. Louis, which is a Christmas staple in my household. So as soon as I saw her, I was like, oh my God, it's Tootie. I way prefer her as Adele here. She was much cuter and sweet, not as much of a brat as Tootie is, but yeah.
Yeah, she's in a bunch of movies. And then the other actress is Little Jane, is also in some future movies. Her name is Peggy Gardner. And she was in A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
Nice. I've heard of that.
Yeah, it's a famous one. I don't really know it, but she is like the main character of that and really carries that. And this, apparently this movie was how they found her for that movie.
Cool.
Which is cool.
Yeah. And isn't Elizabeth Taylor, she's Cleopatra. At least that's right, right?
Yes, that's okay. Right. I have okay. her IMDb up in front of me. And one of the reasons why I don't normally just know the date that Gone with the Wind came out. I had looked it up because I wanted to mention, I think this is a really interesting adaption to talk about the ideas of adaption with, because the trailer for this, did you watch the trailer for this movie?
I saw it started to play on IMDb and it was like a lady going and picking a book off of a bookshelf, but I didn't watch further than that.
Yeah. So it's the trailer for this movie and it looks, I would guess this is like the original from the 40s one. They talk about like, this is a great classic book and they specifically list off other recent adaptions, including Gone with the Wind. Like this is the big book, which is so interesting to me because like you mentioned with the black and white, I immediately went to like, oh, black and white, because that's the time. Gone with the Wind was in color. Yeah. And that was 4 years prior to this. So it was a choice to do this in black and white.
That's a great transition. I have a note here because I was looking at some of the trivia things on IMDb and there's a famous quote from Orson Welles and they mentioned it here too in reference to this movie. But he apparently considered black and white to be an actor's best friend because he thought that it helped focus on an actor's expression and feelings. Whereas that is otherwise maybe lost in like a fully colored scene. You can just be there. And I felt that really came through in this movie too.
Nice. Well, yeah. I love that. And I have one more fact. Do you have anything else? Because I have one more fact before we can go into our ratings and talk about what we're going to watch next week.
I am ready. Go for it, Lillian.
Okay. This is a very random fact, but when I mentioned the version that we were going to watch, my brother Patrick, he goes, well, when I think of Orson Welles, I always think of the drunk wine commercial. And I hadn't seen that. And I'm not going to go into it too much, but if you Google Orson Welles wine commercial, there's outtakes of him shooting a wine commercial where he is so drunk.
Oh my God.
So funny.
Dude, I'll look it up. It sounds good. I was reading a bunch of random Orson Welles facts on this. Like, they're like, oh, well, he used to eat 2 raw steaks a day and like a pint of like alcohol. And then the fact says this later contributed to his severe obesity. And I was like, yeah, doy.
Orson Welles is in and of himself. Like we could do a whole episode about how kooky he is. Like, I don't know. He's one of those names where like, I always feel like I should know more about him than I do. Like he's just such a cultural presence. Mm-hmm. But I don't know a lot about him other than like these weird little tidbits and the general stereotype of him. And I'm like, I think I know enough. this is well, how much I enough. Need to know about Orson Welles.
Yeah. Well, do you want to go first or should I?
Why don't you go first?
Okay. Now I should have checked my previous ratings because I feel like if I was being honestly fair, I should do this in relation to other things, but I want to give this a 9 out of 10, I think, which maybe puts me at the same rating that I gave Timmy D's version, but that might've been a 9.5. I don't know. I technically like the Timmy D version better, but I think this was a quality film. Great adaptation. I give it a 9 out of 10. Pilot the Dogs, because I really liked this enormous spotted Great Dane.
That's amazing.
You sound so...
you stole my rating scale and I don't know what to think. I'm having an emotional reaction to that. And I just need you to respect me having this emotional reaction to you being a thief.
Well, you know, Lillian, I thought sharing was caring. So
I don't think that. I think what's yours is mine. What's mine or what's yours is mine and what's mine's my own. To quote a classic phrase. But I just watched Belfast. For those of you who saw that this weekend, I saw Belfast, another line that's in there a lot. Well, I think maybe we should do like a full like revisit all of the adaptions that we've watched, because I've been rating them on a gut check. I have no idea where this sits in the other ones. And I feel like how I rate these change so much. So that might be an episode you'll see in your feeds sometime in the future. Mm-hmm. But I'm giving this an 8 out of 10. I was going to do Pilot the Dog. So I'm going to stick with Pilot the Dog because I nice. Think it's a great Pilot the Dog. I think it's a solid one. It's a good one. It's not my favorite, but it is really good. And I would highly recommend watching this. I don't know if I would make this the first one you've watched, which if you're listening to this, you haven't watched even a single adaptation of Jane Eyre. But it's definitely, definitely worth a watch, especially if you're a big fan, because I do think it's different in ways that I enjoyed and found really interesting for sure.
Yes. Agreed. Yeah. So Lillian, this means that we've come to another five clusters of adaptations that we've watched, which means we need a break. We need to cleanse our palates, watch something that's not Jane Eyre, and then return to it with fresh eyes. So we have a fantastic palate cleanser set up. Do you want to tell us what that is?
So this was a suggestion that we got on Instagram from Taddy Spring, who's one of our amazing listeners and followers, and we're so grateful for her watching our stuff. And she suggested this, and then I reached out to you. This was weeks ago. I reached out to you and asked if you wanted to do this, and you were like, yes, 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 that was on my list. I'm so excited.
Yes.
And it's North and South. It's the 2004, I believe it was BBC show, that is so amazing. And my experience of watching this is in college, I got a call from you saying, I just finished a show. I need you to watch it right now.
Yes.
And we talked about it and I haven't watched it since then. So this was years and years ago. And aww. I'm so excited to go back and watch it again.
Dude, me too. I have very fond memories of both watching it and freaking out alone, and then later talking with you on the phone for like what felt like at least an hour of being like, and then this happened. And it was so, so cute. So I can't wait to go back. Richard Armitage, ladies and gentlemen, very tall, very straight nose. Cannot wait. It's going to be good.
So that'll be our episode next week while we cleanse our palates, really refresh post Jane Eyre. And then we'll come back to our lady and the wife in the attic and all that good stuff. But I'm starting to expect wives to be locked in all attics. Every time there's a movie, I'm like, but they never did the wedding interruption. They just got married.
I was seeing in our Jane Eyre fan club on Facebook that we're members of, there was a really cute poster. I don't know if you saw it, but some girl was watching the 26 version and her boyfriend walked in and started watching it with her. And he had no idea what the plot was. And he just kept guessing like, what was it? What was responsible? And he's like, is it Adele? Is she setting the bed on fire? And she's like, just you fucking wait. Oh my God. It was so funny. And I'm like, that's the best part about this. It just is the rug. It's pulled completely out from under your feet.
Yeah. We're going to have to find people who haven't watched these and watch them watch it. That'll be what we do in the future, is just like trap people off the street and be like, have you ever heard of Jane Eyre? No. Okay. You need to sit there for 4 hours.
Yeah. Lillian, like what I did to you and Maya, like right after finding this one. And I was like, but watch this.
Well, and you can listen to my that experience of that, because this again is pre-Piper getting the Jane Eyre Stockholm syndrome. So she didn't like it at the time. But you can go listen to World Forge episode, second plug in one episode for your other podcast.
I know that when I told you that it was this big angry rant, but I don't think I can confidently say that I didn't like it. I was definitely kind of like angry, obsessed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Obsession. There's no way it was an obsession.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Definitely had as an obsession right away.
Oh, yes.
Which is how we have a podcast about it now. So.
And it's so great. If you have thoughts about this podcast that you'd like to share with us, you can send us an email. We are airbuds@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us on any number of our amazing social media platforms @airbuds. Lillian manages that and creates some beautiful content. So make sure to find us there and join the conversation, because we have a lot of fun, especially on Instagram.
We do have a lot of fun. Last week we played Bang, Marry, Kill, and I had way too much fun making the graphics for that and like planning out how we are going to do that. So super, super fun stuff. And I just want to say, I know that this is a thing that people say on podcasts and it sounds like nonsense, but I have never really realized how true it is, hopefully for most people, because it certainly is for me. I'm so grateful for our lovely listeners and our little community. And every time somebody says they listen, I'm like shocked and honored. The fact that you spent your time doing this is such a joy for me. And Piper and I talk all the time about how much fun we have making this podcast. And it's absolutely, it's fun to talk to my friend about it. It's fun to record it. It's so much fun to have people listen to it and participate in this conversation with us. And we're so grateful. And if there's anyone that you think would enjoy it, please share it with friends so we can grow our little community. We would love that so much.
Yes, we would. Thank you guys so much for listening, for commenting, for engaging with us. And we wish you a very happy Jane Eyre reading and watching. And we'll see you next week for some North and South. Bye.
Bye.